Where's my order? Does anyone know how to find my order? How can I find
my order?
Break free from customer support monotony. Welcome to Intercom, the customer support platform that uses chatbots, shared inboxes, apps, and more. Intercom's business messenger resolves questions that can be answered automatically, so customer support feels less like Groundhog Day and more like help is on the way. Go to intercom.com/support to learn more.
Happy New Year, animation fans, and welcome once again to the AFA podcast, the official podcast for animationforadults.com. My name is Rachel. I'm host once again hosting this year. If this is your first time tuning in with us, you know, welcome. But also if you're a longtime listener, welcome back. We're very happy to be back for 2021. And joining me today for our chat today is, as always, Chris.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah.
I'm back.
He's back.
It's been a while. Hello.
You're gonna make me start wanting to start singing that song. It's been a while.
Nothing about the
no stains 2021.
Yeah.
It's nothing about stained.
Nothing about the quality of singing. It's the choice of it's yeah.
Fair enough.
No offense, men. Sorry, I'm rusty. Hello.
It's all right. We're really glad to have you back, Chris. And also joining us, we have Dan. Hey, Dan.
Hi.
Hi.
Happy
New Year,
everyone.
Happy 2021. And as well, coming back from our podcast in 2020, we made it to the other side as Evan.
Hey, guys.
It's good to be back and chatting with you guys, because whoo, Nelly. this it's been an interesting start to the year for sure, but still optimistic, still trying to stay optimistic with what's ahead. I know there's gonna be, at least as far as we've looked on the horizon, a lot of really interesting animation projects that are in development and are gonna be released later this year. So that's got us excited. But
it's the year of C-Lab 2021.
Yeah. And of course award season is just around the corner, so at some point we're hoping to go a bit further into discussion about some of the films that might be on the docket for award season, but wanted to keep things casual with kind of a return to our casual water cooler discussion where we talk about, you know, just here and there stuff, old, new stuff that you might have heard, stuff that is probably just like considered a classic or something really obscure. We just talk about what we've been doing over the holiday break and just chat and see what we've been up to. So I guess we'll start going around and see who wants to go first. Chris, I know you said you had a lot that since you've been taking an extended break from the podcast, you've had quite a few things, had a chance to watch a lot of stuff. So why don't we start with you?
No, where to start? But I will start with I will narrow it down a bit, and
okay,
I'll start with one that I think I'm the only one who has watched it, and that is the anime series Demon Slayer, which I decided I better give a try, seeing as it's kind of seems to be a big deal. What with the film that's come out in Japan having beaten Spirited Away's box office in the middle of a pandemic.
That is huge.
That is kind of a big deal. I do wonder if it's anything. I kind of think the pandemic probably maybe, you know, inflated it a bit, because people are just like, oh, I just want to watch something.
That's possible. That's very possible.
Because,
but at the same time,
nothing like Dragon Ball or One Piece, which you think of are as the biggest things. None of their films have, you know, troubled the top 10 even. Never mind having beaten every Hayao Miyazaki film ever.
And yeah, no.
Yeah.
I know the most recent Dragon Ball Super movie did pretty well, all things considered, but it's not nearly that well.
Yeah, so the film that's just come out is called Mugen Train, which apparently means Infinity Train. So,
oh no!
Little. That film will be coming out in the US and UK at some point in 2021. But there is a TV series, and its full title is known as Demon Slayer Kimetsu no Yaiba. Probably pronounced it wrong, but...
I think you actually pronounced it correctly.
No, anyway, I hadn't really looked into it much before because it kind of sounds super generic, just Demon Slayer, and just you look at the pictures and you go, oh, there's a fellow with a big sword.
Part of the course.
Shonen, and it's also feudal area, whatever. Okay, it's called Demon Slayer. He slays demons, whatever. Okay, I mean, I'm sure it's entertaining, but you know, that sounds like a million other anime.
What's different about this one?
Having started to watch it, I'm only about 6 episodes in. Okay. Basically, there isn't like a great deal that's different about it so far. You start off with basically your generic, nice, friendly shonen hero, like, ah, he's just a nice guy.
Something terrible is going to have to happen.
Yep. He is with his family in like feudal Japan. They do say which era in it, I can't remember what it is, but it's feudal Japan. he heads off, he says goodbye to his big family, and he heads off to go down to the village. They live in the mountain. He goes down to the village to sell charcoal to the villagers, as he does regularly. But there's a big snowstorm and he gets stuck there, and he stays with some fella who makes some sort of dire warnings about demons on the mountain or something. He goes, oh yeah, whatever. And he goes up, goes back to his family, they've all been murdered, which is a part, you know, quite shocking for him, I'd imagine. So he returns to his family to find they've all been murdered, except for one of his sisters, who seems to have been possessed by a demon or turned into a demon. He takes her and like to try and he runs away with her, basically, even though she's a demon.
What's a demon in this world? Does that mean like a big monster or...
They seem to be, I guess they're like, you know, Japanese mythological idea of demons, you know, that
tradition. Yeah, yokai.
Yeah, sort of thing. There's but they also seem to be able to possess people, and they need to eat human flesh to survive or something. There's kind of like, oh, let's nick a bit of vampirism or zombieism, Western ideas, put them in when we feel like it, sort of thing. But long story short is that he ends up training to join the Demon Slayer Corps because basically he runs into a Demon Slayer and who tries to slay his sister, but he decides, no, I've got to protect my sister even though she's being possessed by a demon.
Yeah.
And this Demon Slayer guy basically decides, hey, there's something about this kid. I reckon he could become a demon slayer. So he sort of suggests that he goes somewhere and recommends it to someone. To start his training. And okay. That he meets an old geezer in like one of those Oni masks, like with the, you get lots of characters in those sort of masks in this. But yeah, as I said, there's not anything that is particularly innovative or anything about this idea, and you kind of go, I could, you know, but it's just like one of those cases of where it's just, it's really well done. It's done by, I never know how you're supposed to say it, UFO table or UFO table or
UFO table, yeah,
or
that's how I call it.
Looks like it should either be UFO table or it should be UFO table, just to be consistent. it looks really good, the animation quality, and it's got some of the like best integrated CG I've seen in an anime series.
That's impressive.
There's like this, because it's all sort of like, most of it's been set in like snowy mountains in forests and stuff so far. And there is this, like this one fight, like in one of the first episodes in a forest, like snowy forest, and the camera all whizzing around and stuff. And it's like one of the best looking anime action sequences I've seen in a long time.
Very good.
So, yeah, it's basically just, you can put it in line with stuff like Attack on Titan and My Hero Academia in just really high production value shonen stuff rather than the stuff that they just pump out every week for TV, you know, where they've gone, right, we're going to do a 26 episode season, and they've just done one so far, and then they've done the movie, which...
That's impressive. Frame,
which looks like it's going to be entertaining as well. And then I guess because it's so popular, I'd imagine there's going to be more seasons. Although the manga has finished apparently. So
That's interesting because it is a Shonen Jump title, right? Like it's from the same magazine where you got like your Naruto's and Bleach and One Piece.
Yeah,
so that's it's interesting that it's already finished. I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
and that rarely ever happens.
Last year, and it's I guess
only 23 volumes.
It kind of sounds like, you know, probably just the artist wanted to finish it. They were, you know, they got to the end of the story.
Yeah, but like that's a luxury, like especially with like Shonen Jump. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm. It's my understanding
Oda, you must never end. You must never end One Piece.
I think Oda enjoys it, but like Musashi Kishimoto.
Yeah, for Naruto. Yeah, he was literally like, because they were forcing him to keep up with this, he was like getting actually sick from working on this manga for so long.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often, frankly.
I think it does, but you just don't hear about it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You just hear about it when it's a high profile guy like him.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm intrigued to check this out now you mentioned it, because that was the thing with My Hero Academia, where like I'd watched it and I really enjoyed it, and I found myself recommending it to people and just going like, it's, you know what it is, it's shonen, but it's just done really well. Like it's not actually necessarily innovative, but it's just a simple story done well.
Exactly. And sometimes that's all you need.
Yeah. And you know that like for like a new generation of anime fans, you know, it's going to be the thing that they come across and think, you know, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen or whatever, because they haven't seen Naruto and one, you know, Dragon Ball. They had, you know, it's, everyone has their gateway show or whatever.
Exactly.
And this is going to be that for a whole generation. But it's just, you know, it's just really well done. And I am intrigued to check out some more and get to. And it's basically streaming on Funimation and one and Crunchyroll. And it's coming to Netflix as well.
It's coming to Netflix this week.
Damn. Really,
so it's on Netflix as we speak, probably by the time you're listening to this.
Superb.
Most excellent. I'll have to add that to my list. I've already been kind of curious of checking that out because I've seen images of the character designs for the characters of the show. And I have to say, I really, really like the look of the characters, and especially the color palette, because like there's always like a design, or like there's like just a color, a particular color in the characters have like on them, like either a piece of clothing or like the color of their eyes or something, that's just very bright, vibrant colors to them, which really helps them pop off the screen. But no, yeah, I'm really, now that I have that as an option, I'm while I wait for My Hero Academia to get its next season off the ground, I will have to give that a watch.
Yeah, I recommend it. I recommend it so far. I hope it doesn't take a dive off the cliff after 7 episodes or whatever, but
I sincerely hope so as well.
Yeah,
with the manga finished, we can only, I would only hope that they would they would avoid having to try and make a hard detour off of what the actual story is. But that, you know, you who knows what could happen.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like when you get when they do seasons or whatever, just normal length seasons, we're basically avoiding the let's have seven seasons worth of filler while we wait for the artist to catch up.
It's incredible that they let that happen. it's really crazy to think that that was a regular thing.
I know, for so long.
It just made me think of like if there was, you know, like a big American series, something like Game of Thrones or Stranger Things or whatever, and you had the big storyline, and then at the end of it, you go, oh, well, now there's going to be a season where Daenerys goes on holiday.
Okay, you know what, though? The truth is that if that happened on something like, I don't know, if that happened on certain shows, I would 100% be there for it. It's kind of like how, like, in the Marvel movies.
We want the sitcom.
My favorite stuff was always, yeah, my favorite scenes were always when they were just, like, you know, at a bar together.
Yeah.
And just, like, there was banter and...
like an Age of Ultron, yeah. when they're all trying to lift Thor's hammer.
That's the best scene in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Easily.
Yeah. Anything else, Chris, in the way of like anime, maybe?
I
don't know.
I have watched something that has just come out on Blu-ray and DVD in the US via G Kids and Shout Factory, and that is the CG movie of Lupin the Third,
Oh, hey, I've seen that. Confusingly
titled, yes. It's going to be released in the UK by Anime Limited this year as well. And this is the very first CG outing for the iconic gentleman thief, Lupin the Third. And we've talked very excitedly about trailers when they came out.
Mm-hmm.
Because they took everyone by surprise, because A, we didn't know there was going to be this Lupin movie, and also everyone was just blown away by the quality of it, which seemed to be like capturing the animation of Lupin in 3D perfectly, like probably the best high quality like Japanese CG we've seen, or sort of. I guess the Dragon Quest thing, that was also really well done.
Yeah, that's what I was studio, looking at the trailers. Wasn't it?
Yeah, there's definitely some sort of connection. I did think it was the same director at first, but then I discovered it wasn't, I think. But I think they might be the same studio. It's a Lupin movie.
Yes.
Very much a Lupin movie, and it is kind of in the spirit of more Castle of Cagliostro sort of thing rather than some of the grittier Lupin.
Yeah, it's pitched as like a family.
Yeah, kind of, definitely. Like,
more family-ish style movie.
But one of the coolest thing is it's a period piece. It's sort of set in, I guess, it's a little while since I've seen it. It's 60s, is it? 50s, 60s?
Like somewhere around there.
Because it starts off like in the war. Like there's a flashback sort of sequence. And you know how Lupin's always had like a retro sort of feel because it started at the end of the 60s or early 70s or whatever. I've always wanted them to do a new Bond movie and take it back to the 60s sort of thing. That's a common thing people want.
Yeah.
I start to say everyone wants it. That's not true. But
I want it.
I know what you mean. You've had enough people say that. Because there's a kind of simplicity that happens when you strip away technology and modern conveniences.
Yeah, you kind of think that Bond should be like fighting communist Russians rather than, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or whatever.
Same thing. My gosh. Yep.
But So it's got like a 60s set setting. So like it means the cars are more appropriate and things. And it's also, it means that you can have actual Nazis. Well, yeah, we know they're back. the original German Nazis.
the OGs.
The OGs. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a globe-trotting thing, starting off in France, and Lupin's after a diary, and it is apparently the one thing that Lupin the First, who was his great-grandfather, well, not his grandfather, I think they say, obviously, couldn't steal. So it's got, you know, an extra importance to him. But basically, the plot is kind of bobbins, really. It doesn't really matter. It's the point is...
That's not what you're here for.
Which in many ways is like a James Bond movie. Like, yeah. Tell me the story of any James Bond movie that you like. You can't.
No.
It's...
No.
Criminal mastermind tries to take over the world or blow up a country and...
There you go. That's yeah. It. That's the only story there is.
Yeah, but there are always lots of more twist to it than that, and you could never explain all the different things. Oh, yeah, so it's basically, yeah, it kind of a little bit James Bond, a little bit Indiana Jones.
Very Indiana Jones, I'd say.
This one has got more Indiana Jones in it than your average Lupin.
I would say mainly, like, the thing for me that makes it feel Indiana Jonesy is obviously the Nazis.
Yeah.
Some of the scenery.
Yep, because there's deserty stuff. And
I don't want to spoil it, but the sort of thing that, you know, like in Indiana Jones 4, love it or hate it, they leaned into this thing that these movies were always pulpy.
Yeah.
And they went, according to some people, a bit too far with what that would mean in the 50s. And I think Lupin, like, it kind of pulls it off, like, in a way that maybe Indiana Jones couldn't.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
I'm obviously talking around something, which I'm trying not to.
I'm curious about what specifically you're talking about.
Basically, I'll say, like, a sci-fi element.
Okay,
which
right, yeah.
Is not really maybe what you'd expect from Lupin, but I feel like it threads the needle in a... in a satisfying way. I mean, the thing for me as well about this movie is that, like, you know, we're saying the plot's really simple, but you want it to be that way, because then it just has, it's like a Mission Impossible movie as well.
Yeah.
You know, like, you want it to be a simple plot so you can just have fun with these set pieces, and each character has space to, you know, run around and bounce off each other. And I think the thing for me was, like, I knew that it was always going to be, based on the trailers, like a visual treat.
Yeah.
But this nice surprise for me with the movie was that it's actually really nicely paced and a pretty decent introduction to the characters, if that is, you know, if it is your first, like, Lupin movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like Cagliostro was for many other people.
But if it's not your first Lupin movie, there's so many pleasures of just like, oh, that is so, you know, you go, oh, that is such a Fujiko thing to do. Or, you know, or like...
She's great in this.
Please tell me Goemon's in it. Please tell me Goemon's in it.
Yeah.
They're all good.
Everyone you would want to see is in it.
And okay, good. This is definitely verging into spoiler territory, but you know how there were certain movies, certain Lupin entries where Lupin and Zenigata end up having to, you know, be on the same side for a little bit, kind of.
Yeah,
bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And that bit is always fun.
I love that trope. It's such a great trope. Like, you know, whenever Sherlock Holmes has to team up with, what's his name, his inspector. and Poirot teaming up with Jap.
Mm.
It's a great trope, but yeah, it's definitely like kind of like how Cagliostro, you know, like has a slightly softer version of all the characters.
Yeah, definitely.
This one is definitely, yeah, like your more family friendly version of the characters, but they're still, I mean, they still pretty much feel intact.
Yeah, they're recognisably the characters, and in every way that matters. Pretty much nothing seems out of character for them.
No.
That's good to hear. That's good. That's a, because when you say a softer version of the characters, I know that that can be a, doing that can be, you know, you can go dangerously into making characters act out of character, but it's good that they were able to toe that line.
Yeah. I mean, well, way back, like, wasn't Costa Cagliostro criticized for that?
Yeah,
like, yeah.
Lupin too.
Including by Monkey Punch himself, who didn't like that version of Lupin. Really? But
yeah.
Still, it's, you know, it's my favourite Lupin still, so what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Although, speaking of it being very, very soft, version of Lupin, his hair looks incredibly soft, like you can stroke it. It looks, yeah, just the detail on it, like, you could like see like the texture on his suit and things like that, and like you can like, and on Goemon's hat and everything. It's just, yeah, just the detail.
It's really amazing. Interesting how the film was stylized, because it really does feel like, I don't know how to put this. It does feel like a Japanese animation film.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like
Pixar.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like everything's been stylized in a way that Pixar wouldn't necessarily. Mm. It's cartoony in the right places, but has its own sense of bending reality in other places as well. And I really enjoyed that part of it. It's just so much fun to watch. Mm. Like, the action scenes are so good.
Yeah, the car chases.
I mean, I'd argue that the car chase is like as good as the one in Castle Cagliostro as well.
That's high praise.
Yeah, it is fantastic. Yeah, and you get like chases over the Paris rooftop and things like that. And you get the amazing music as well. It's got one of the best theme songs in history of any sort. If you are a Lupin fan from way back and you remember like the Lupin part two, like the dub they did with that cast, for a lot of people though, that particular cast is kind of, you know, in inescapably linked with Lupin now. And when it was picked up, people were like, please cast the, you know, the classic Lupin cast. And G-Kids did, which is great. So yeah, it's got
oh, interesting.
So in the dub you get Tony Oliver as who's a bit of a classic voice actor as Lupin, and you get Michelle Ruff as Fujiko, and you get Richard Epcar as Jingen, which is he is a brilliant voice actor with a great gravelly voice, and perfect for Jingen. And I think he voice directed the original dubs of it, I don't know.
Hmm.
Yeah. And on the Blu-ray you get a little there's some cool special features, including a reunion of the voice cast, which is obviously it's obviously been done in recent times, so it's done over something approximating Zoom or whatever. So there's no actual video of it. You just see like representations to them, and you hear the voices. And there's some cool special features with the Japanese cast as well, who seem to be pretty fun in the same sort of way.
I liked the it has some interesting stuff about how the film was made as well.
Yeah.
Which was interesting to me, like the fact that they did They did actually, funnily enough, in terms of development, they did work in a Pixar-ish kind of way.
Yeah.
Where they storyboarded the whole film first, and then they put it up in an animatic form and reworked it. And they also, which is not common in Japanese animation, they pre-recorded the voices.
Yeah.
Usually Japanese animation, the voice actors are in a booth, like, you know, working to animation that's already been like colored pretty much. So that was like a slightly different way of working, and it was just a good movie.
it's so much fun. Thoroughly recommend it, whether you're a Lupin fan or not.
In terms of watching this, you think recommend, because you said it's going to be coming out on Blu-ray here in the US. So that would be the best way to watch it. There's no, you know, it's not on any, as we know, it's not on any streaming service at this time.
Not currently.
I think there's going to be a digital version.
There is a digital version you can get. That it was really, actually, it came out on digital quite early, like in December, because of what, with one thing and another last year, the cinema release was kind of, you know, hard to get to, and a lot of people probably didn't want to go to, so they basically put it out on digital really quickly and got it out on Blu-ray and DVD, you know, as quickly as they can, which is this January, but they put it out on like the digital version even earlier. But I will say that GK seemed to have been signing up a lot of their stuff with HBO Max. They had the Ghibli deal at first, but a whole bunch of other things, like the Masaaki Yuasa films, like Ride Your Way, and Night is Short.
Night is Short, Walk On Girl.
Yeah, which has got a new dub for the streaming version as well. You might start seeing more G-Kid stuff on HBO Max in the US, I guess.
All right.
So that might turn up there at some point, but it's worth picking up anyway if you love Lupin and you love just really high quality cartoony animation.
Your favorite things feel made for you. Your education should too. University of Maryland Global Campus, formerly University of Maryland University College, was made to serve the military and working adults like you. Today, we continue that tradition by offering frequent start dates so you can get started with convenient online learning that fits your schedule, by recognizing your accomplishments with credits you can earn for what you know, by providing no-cost online resources replacing most textbooks because a college education can fit your budget too, and with no SAT or GRE required for most programs. University of Maryland Global Campus, made for you. Last year, we awarded more than $15 million in scholarships to qualified students, including community college students, service members, veterans, and working adults just like you. Discover how we can make your education and your goals for the future a reality. Visit us at umgc.edu. That's umgc.edu. Certified to operate in Virginia by Chev.
Where's my order? Does anyone know how to find my order?
How can I find my order?
Break free from customer support monotony. Welcome to Intercom, the customer support platform that uses chatbots, shared inboxes, apps, and more. Intercom's business messenger resolves questions that can be answered automatically, so customer support feels less like Groundhog Day and more like help is on the way. Go to intercom.com/support to learn more.
Done in CG. It's amazing.
Nice. Okay, so who wants to go next? I'm tempted to go next because of we were talking kind of like about like spy themed movies, and that's going to tie into one of the films I had a chance to see over the holidays. Because unfortunately I had to spend some isolation during New Year's. So on the night of on New Year's Eve, I decided to just, you know, put on just a movie that I'd been, you know, I've been kind of dragging my feet on a little bit, but I'm like, you know what? I might as well give that a watch. And that is, Spies in Disguise. It was a film that came out early 2020, if I recall. And it is from Blue Sky Studios, and it was it's starring Will Smith and Tom Holland are the two main lead characters of the film. And the whole crux or the hook of the movie is that you have Will Smith, who's playing Agent Sterling, who's like this really like, you know, like James Bond would be envious in terms of how good this guy is at his job. Mm-hmm. In terms of being a spy and, you know, beating up bad guys and blowing stuff up, that kind of thing, with, you know, the hot cars and all that good and all that, you know, typical spy stuff. But he runs into one of the people who supplies him with his tech, Walter, who is played by Tom Holland. Through one accident or another, he takes a bit of Walter's technology, which turns him into a pigeon. And so he has to try and solve this mystery of someone disguised as him who are basically stealing this really deadly tech, and has to try and clear his name while being disguised as a pigeon. And at first glance, when I saw the trailer and I saw the promotional material for the movie, I'm like, oh, this is going to be bad. This is going to be like, you know, I'm going to fall asleep during this. Like, I know that's basically the original reason I put it on. It's like, I just something to go on in the background while I was cooking on New Year's Eve. And I ended up watching it, a lot of it, and enjoying everything about it more so than I was floored by how much this movie like turned me around in terms of how much I enjoyed it, because it's, what's the word I'm looking for, like, it's almost deceptive. Like it's like an idea on paper that like really shouldn't work,
mm-hmm.
but it does.
I and a lot of feed it to,
yeah, yeah. So but give me your opinion there, Chris.
I concur that it is excellent, but I just have to point out that this film, for some reason, is the animation film that my mum decided that she really, really, really wanted to see and was very excited about. She's very, you know, very kind and tolerant and everything of my love for animation. And, she, you know, she'll watch animation films with me or, like, with my nieces, her grandkids.
But she's got to be talked into it.
Well, no, not really. But she doesn't, you know, she doesn't express any particular interest in advance or whatever, you know, or opinion, mm-hmm. particularly, you know, apart from like the odd Aardman thing, you know, that's just the British thing, everyone loves Aardman or whatever. but she went to see Frozen 2 with my nieces, and she came back saying that she'd seen the trailer for this and when was it coming out, and she really wanted to see it and she can't wait, and she asked me several times. So like, as soon as it was on, because it's on Disney Plus in the UK. I know it isn't in the US, but as soon as it was on there...
Yeah, it's on HBO Max in the US.
We had to watch it. And, you know, I wasn't expecting that much about it. But, you know, because it was this thing that she really wanted to watch, I wanted to watch it with her. And I was so impressed, unexpectedly, because, like, the very first part, it's just a really good spy movie.
Yeah, yeah. You just see Lance Sterling doing his thing, and it's just like a fun run through of all of these typical like tropes or cliches of what you would normally expect from like a really high octane James Bond film, or just or any kind of spy thriller, really, just with Will Smith's usual level of sass. Presence, I guess.
There's just this brilliant action sequence at the beginning where he's like taking on a load of ninjas, and it's a bit like Kill Bill, like the, I can't remember what it's called, like the House of a Thousand Assassins or whatever that bit's mm-hmm. called. And it's just really visually impressive and kinetic and exciting and stuff. And it's just so much better than you'd expect it would need to be for the idea it is.
Well, I think what really holds the film together, at least in my personal opinion, is the fact that you have both Tom Holland and Will Smith acting off each other. They're co-stars in this movie, and both actors have charisma for days. So it's really fun to just watch them act off each other in this movie in varying situations. And I think in terms of the whole, what really turned me around to the concept of this movie is Tom Holland's character, because he's one of the many scientists in this secret agent, you know, organization who makes the gadgets. But what makes him unique compared to everyone else around him is that he insists on making gadgets that are non-lethal.
Oh yeah.
Like he makes a flotation device, or like a safety device called the inflatable hug, or the cat glitter, which is supposed to just make everyone's like, oh, if people are happy, then they won't want to punch you, you know?
That's kind of a surprising thing to have in a family movie as well, the idea that the other agents or whatever do kill people.
Yeah, that's kind of what really turned me on. Like I said, it was turning me on to the whole concept of the movie in terms of what it's like. I guess it's not really a lesson. It's more of like a talking point that the movie brings up. And in terms of like, okay, you know, no, we're actually hurting and killing people when we go out and we do these things. And Tom Holland's character's insisting like, no, there's another way we can do this. And that ends up being a real sticking point for later in the film, because it's a recurring element, I should say. And it plays a bigger role in the climax of the movie. It's basically when I think the whole climax was built around, and the climax is amazing. I could watch that over and over again.
There's also lots of really great slapstick comedy with the pigeons and stuff. And I have to say that I never thought in my life that I would hear the word cloaca so often in a kids movie.
Okay.
Yeah. That was, I wasn't expecting that either. But no, yeah, just having Tom Holland and Will Smith be co-stars together is just wonderful. And I know I'm going to watch this movie again and again. I don't know how often, but I know that whenever I can't think of anything else to play, I'm most likely to put that movie on, because it's just such a fun time.
Definitely made me want to go back and rewatch it.
If only for like those moments where like especially the action sequences, like the car chase near the beginning of the film after Will Smith's turned into a pigeon, or even just the whole sequence of him turning into a pigeon is played up hilariously with Tom Holland just saying, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. Meanwhile, it's like almost playing out like a horror film for Will Smith. I was pleasantly surprised by this movie. And if there's anyone else out there who had my kind of initial gut reaction as to like, oh, I'm not going to give this the time of day, maybe give it another shot when you're in the mood for that kind of, you know, spy action kind of movie, adventure movie, because it may surprise you.
That's good to know, because I think it was definitely a film that was aggressively marketed.
It was.
I seem to remember like seeing trailers for it for about a year as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we mentioned that on this podcast. Like,
I think so too.
Not out yet. Like multiple times.
Well, it got caught up with the whole Disney Fox deal, didn't it? Because it ended up being owned by Disney. So they then wanted, well, we don't want it to come out at the same time as Frozen or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I forgot. Sorry. That's like 1,000 years ago.
I know. Just the year of 2020 felt like 10 years packed into one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 2020 but, lasted 17 years. So it's
under. Yes. But no, yeah, highly recommend that movie. How about we go to Evan, if you would like to share anything that you were checking out over the holiday?
You know, I've kind of been on this weird kick where I'm just kind of like looking for that like super underground, like old, like independent animation. Have any of you guys heard of John Hubley? He was an animator. You have, Dan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So it might be more popular than I think, but I mean, he's been gone for a few decades. He died in the 70s, but he was the creator of the Mr. Magoo cartoon character.
And
And he also made the little kid like Marky Mapo for like the Mapo oatmeal commercials.
Oh my gosh.
He made feature-length films with his wife that were very experimental and really kind of beautiful in their own way. It's not like anything I've ever seen. I bought this. The thing is, like, it's really hard to find his movies. I'm not quite sure what that is. If it's like a lack of interest, or I think he was like blacklisted, from like Hollywood, like during the Red Scare, because he wouldn't give out names or something. While that whole like communist, you know, like witch hunt was going on. I really just don't know. But his last feature film, Everybody Rides the Carousel, is on the Criterion Channel. You can't buy it as a DVD or anything. But I watched it, you know, just out of curiosity, and it was probably one of the best films like I've seen all year. It was just, it couldn't have been like hardly more than an hour, but it was just very I think the word is like emotional realism, like that's how people described him. Like he would manipulate the animation so that it like reflected the inner psychology of the characters. It's hard to describe. You just kind of have to experience it, but it was great. It was about the life cycle, about growing up and self-actualizing and, you know, eventually coming to terms with the reality of death. And as grim as that sounds, the way that he portrayed it was very human and very moving. If you guys ever get a subscription to Criterion, check it out.
And what was the name of the movie again, just one more time?
Everybody Rides the Carousel.
Everybody Rides the Carousel.
I mean, like, the production value pales in comparison to what you see nowadays, because the animation is very minimalistic, but it's charming in its own way. He has other stuff out there that's probably more well known. I think his short Moonbird won an Oscar when it was released, like back in the 60s or whatever. And it was interesting because Hubley actually recorded his children at play and built the animation around that. It was completely unscripted.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so when you hear the kids, like the animated kids playing with each other, it's so organic and believable because they're not acting. They're actually, you know, two kids just going at it. It's things like that just kind of characterized his work, on top of like his visual style that made him unlike any other person. He died really young too, so it would have been interesting to see if more came from him, you know, had he lived longer. But that's all I got. I know that's kind of like you know, probably like a hole in the wall kind of stuff, so not sure if it's anything we could really talk about.
It's a great recommendation, because it's you know, stuff like, you know, like we were talking about, like Spies in Disguise, like that got advertised out the wazoo. So it's just like you know, it's nice to kind of have like two different points of talking about something that, you know, got a lot of exposure versus something that didn't get a lot of exposure for whatever reason. And, you know, paying, you know, reverence to, you know, creators, you know, whose work might not have gotten as, you know, not too many people might have seen it. I like drawing attention to things like that. So thanks for sharing that, man.
Yeah. It's good. It's good to find hidden gems, and it's good to, you know, celebrate stuff that's in the limelight. Like, you know, I saw Soul. That was a great film too, you know?
Yeah. I hope we can have a longer discussion about Soul, 'cause that's definitely something that a movie that I think deserves a full episode to talk about, 'cause there's a lot to unpack with Soul. Mm-hmm. There's a lot there.
That's all I got though.
That's all right.
Dan, have you already shared?
I don't believe so.
Basically I have. I mean, I just want to like go back to Hubley. I think he's a really interesting person to check out if you haven't, because, you know, in fact, he's the reason that he made films the way he did was very much because of Disney. You know, he worked at Disney.
Mm-hmm.
in the early, I mean, I think he worked on Fantasia and like Dumbo and Bambi. And he was part of this movement in the 50s of, you know, Disney was the one-stop shop at the time. And there were a lot of artists at the studio, you know, the studio and buzzing around town who wanted to figure out a way of doing animation cheaper because it hadn't really been done, particularly in a commercial way. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, you know, how he's not exactly mainstream, but he's a reaction to it in many ways. I think he's a fascinating filmmaker, really. I've not seen all of his stuff because, as you say, like, it's hard to find. But I've seen Moonbird and a few other things he had done. And I love him. Stuff I've seen, I don't know, you know, in December, with Christmas, the thing always happens to me where I'm like ignoring it, rejecting it until like December 15th, and then I turn into Who Loves Christmas? I don't know, you know, like a lunatic. And I wanted to feel cozy and Christmassy. And one of the things that I really, because, you know, like in the UK, we don't have like all of the same staples of Christmas specials in the US. We don't have, like, The Grinch isn't really popular.
Mm.
The only Rankin Bass cartoon that made it over here was Rudolph. I'm kind of familiar with him. But, you know, like, we don't have, like, these... Anyway, so, like, the thing for me that was that was Simpsons specials.
Ah.
And I just watched a bunch of Christmas Simpsons, and it's such a damn good show. And I don't know, it's you know, like, newsflash, Simpsons is good still, but it really, a lot of it really hasn't dated, and it's still, you know, like, particularly the episode Marge Be Not Proud, where Bart wants to play Bonesaw. No, not Bonesaw. That's Bone. What's it called? Bone Storm. He wants to play the video. He wants to play the video game, and it's you know, it's too expensive, and he can't have
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And and he steals it, and it's just a great little Christmas story. Really,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. It was just a delight. And I saw a bunch of The Simpsons, and it just sort of got me off watching The Simpsons. Oh, and also, I want to shout out, because things get buried so quickly,
mm-hmm.
Especially on, like, streaming services, is that they released a few more Mickey Mouse cartoons on Disney.
Oh, yes.
Well, yeah. You know what I think of these. I think they're excellent. They're really funny. There's the slight change in format. Like, you know, usually the shorts were about 3.5 minutes, and then occasionally they do sort of more 7-minute episodes. All of these new episodes, I think the series is called The Wonderful World of Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, it's made for Disney Plus, this one. It's a difference, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh.
But it's other than that, it's pretty much the same deal, the same crew. And the same, like, look of the show. It's not changed that much, but every episode is like at least 7 minutes. So it's an interesting slight change in format where there are slightly longer stories going on. But it's just some of the best modern cartoons that you can hope to see, I think.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear.
And apart from that, I don't know, I've been watching, I saw Soul as well, and there is, as you say, a lot to unpack. I feel like I need to see it again.
Yeah.
No, totally, yeah. Because
I don't really know, you know, I've read a few things after having seen it that made digesting it a little bit more uncomfortable than I had expected.
Really?
Yeah. And I think that there is some interesting arguments to be made in that regard.
Okay.
Sounds interesting.
Animation-wise, I don't really know. I don't really know what I've been watching. I've been making animation. I've been busy doing that.
I mean, that takes up a lot of time.
It does. Thank you. Yeah, no, it does.
You're right. We are the true heroes.
Yeah. I've been watching Evangelion as well.
Oh, yes. Boy.
Which is like, it's I'm still like in the middle of it, and it's interesting. Yeah, it's definitely. I first watched it when I was like, I must have been like 15 or something, and I think there's a lot of young male gazy stuff which I'm noticing a lot more this time.
Oh,
whereas okay. when I was 15, I was like, oh, this is really cool. And now I'm watching it and I'm like, all right, you creep.
We're getting into some
guy next here.
The male gaze.
Sorry, Evan?
No, nothing. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know. That's really what I've been doing, really. Animation wise, I wish.
Well,
I
like you said, you've been doing a lot of working on animation, which, like you said, takes up a lot of time. So
the thing I noticed,
it's only a lot of time for other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I noticed as well is like, I'm constantly watching old stuff, and I'm not really conscious of what I'm watching sometimes. So, I'll just say like the Lupin movie was great.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a new thing to look out for. And I don't know when the release is, Chris. You're going to have to help me out on this one. But I do want to seed now being excited for Calamity.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Release-wise, it is getting its US premiere as part of the Animation First Festival. French Animation Festival, which is normally held in New York, but
right.
For some reason it's being held online this year. So
that was good timing, Chris.
Yeah. it's going to be available from anywhere in the US to watch it, and the director is also going to do a Q&A thing.
Okay, well, in that case then you have no excuse, and I really recommend catching that, because it's well worth your time.
And it's going to get a bigger release later in the year.
Good.
Yeah.
Great film.
Yes, I heard that. It is great. it's so much fun. It's really entertaining.
And actually,
mark your calendars, everybody.
One thing you can do is, in preparation for that, is check out Remy. Is it Chaye?
Chaye.
His first film, which is, I don't think, gets seen enough or talked about enough. Long Way North.
Yes, that is also
Primes you very nicely for what to expect in Calamity.
And if you can't find it and you're in the US, you will be able to see that as part of Animation First. So there you go.
Sure.
And
yay!
It is
you bloody go.
February 5th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time.
Nice. Very good.
Well done, Evan. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we're almost about to wrap up. I think there was one other thing that I checked out recently. I guess I should say I went back to as kind of like, you know, a good dose of comfort food. And also related to an outside project I've been working on with some friends of mine in my new Dungeons & Dragons circle. I went back and I watched Disney's Treasure Planet because it's one of my top five Disney films of all time. I really, really enjoy the way it it helped me appreciate the story of Treasure Island all the more, because I'd read the book, I'd seen other adaptations of it, but I never really understood the connection that John Silver and Jim Hawkins are supposed to have with each other, like the father-son bond, the relationship that they're supposed to have, you know, even though that he, you know, Silver always kind of walks that, like, that moral gray area and kind of flits back and forth between a good guy, bad guy, you know, what have you. But I feel like, at least in my particular, in my context, I was able to get that, I was able to understand that a lot clearer, that connection in this film, which is why, one of the reasons I love it so much. And also there's the aesthetic, which is, I know, hit and miss for certain people, but I absolutely love it. And turns out is actually works very well with some parts of the D&D setting, because there are actual ships in D&D that can go between space or dimensions called Spelljammers. And they basically look like those ships in Treasure Planet. So
yeah,
my friends and I were trying to put together, like, oh, we're going to do kind of like a hub world where we can go to multiple different like settings in Dungeons and Dragons. And we're kind of trying to figure out what aesthetic we want. And then someone mentioned Treasure Planet. And I was like, yes, 100%. Let's do it.
You guys all have to help me with my history, but wasn't that like one of the last Disney films to use 2D?
It was before they tried to do the things.
It was definitely the last one that they had a lot riding on. Mm-hmm. That disappointed, because it was Ron Clements and John Muscatel.
Yeah, this was like a passion project that they've been pushing since before they made The Little Mermaid.
Yeah,
like they wanted to make The Little Mermaid. They wanted to make it back when they made The Little Mermaid.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I think it was, they put their all into it, but by that point, I think like it was after Atlantis, wasn't it?
It was, I think.
And like, Atlantis didn't even do as well as they had hoped. That hadn't really, you know, captured the audience that they wanted. And then Treasure Planet had basically a similar kind of target audience of like, you know, young boys, basically.
Yeah, which it was.
Yeah, it was, and I remember the marketing.
Sorry, Chris.
It was 2002.
Yes, yeah, and I remember, like, I was like 12 when that came out, 12, 11, and I remember, like, even then, like, feeling like, I watched Dragon Ball. I don't really like need that from Disney. Like, what's going on?
Yeah, both Atlantis and Treasure Planet really were kind of like a hard break from, you know, what we typically associate with Disney, like the fairy tale elements and all that. Like, there were no songs, at least it's not like actual like character songs.
It's kind of fascinating, and I think it's definitely something that Disney is still trying to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
I think I wouldn't be surprised if you know, we see them pushing that particularly in the marketing of what the hell is any movie about the dragon that looks
Last Dragon.
Yeah, like that. Like, it looks like a lot more of an action flick than obviously like Frozen. And
mm-hmm.
I guess they wanted Big Hero 6 to be that, but then that didn't really have the sticking, you know,
mm-hmm. power.
So yeah, I think it's like something they're always trying to crack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite fascinating that they don't really have a formula for it yet, because they don't have a success in those terms.
Well, and this is just my own kind of like, and this might just be in my imagination, but I don't think really, at least as far as Clements and Musker were concerned, when they wanted to work on this project for a long time, but I don't think at least the higher ups of Disney at that time really put a lot of stock in their project, even after they gave them the green light.
No.
Which is why the advertising was absolutely horrendous. I remember, like, I wanted to see it just from those initial trailers that I had seen when the film was first being promoted, but then as it was getting closer to air, you know, to be released in theaters, and then they had like all these, you know, trailers were showing Jim Hawkins on his board thing, that the solar sailor, and or the it's a great sequence, but they were like, oh my god, this is so radical, because this is like late 90s going to the 2000s, so they were still holding on to 90s vernacular, and it's just like, no, don't stop talking about the film. And they showed a lot of scenes with the Martin Short character too, which again, not one of the highlights of the film.
The audience said, hey, we've already seen this movie when it was called Titan AE. Anyone remember that?
I remember that, but I think they came out around the same time, didn't they?
Yeah, it was
apparently Titan AE was like 2000, 99?
Which I can't believe. 2000? Yeah, it was 2000.
Really? I thought it was like 98.
No, I thought it was, I was thinking it was like 2002, 2003, so.
Yeah.
Dumb proof. Trying to do an action movie in space.
It happened. It was enjoyable. I'll admit, I found it in parts of it enjoyable. Just the CG, like I look at it now and I'm like, ooh. I definitely think that the CG in our computer generated animation that they included for Treasure Planet definitely holds up a lot better, for sure. Like,
yeah, it's like kind of cel shaded sort of quality that they knew to kind of go for. How do you think it holds up as a? Sorry, I know we're sort of wrapping up, but how do you think it holds up as a Treasure Island adaptation?
Like I said, and this is again my own personal perspective, but you know, obviously there's a lot of stuff that they omit from the original book and the story. Like, you don't see certain pirate characters that got named in the book. We never see them show up. But at the same time, I think they cherry-picked elements of the story that made sense. Like, okay, we have to kind of do this because it's, you know, integral to the story. But at the same time, they took certain liberties with it. But they never lost sight of what makes the story good, which is the connection between those two characters. Yeah. And the interactions that they have with each other while they're on the ship, and then when the mutiny happens and post that, and then you know, finding the treasure, etc. Like, I don't know, like I think it's probably my favorite interpretation of the story, because I've seen Muppet Treasure Island, which I would say was probably my second favorite adaptation of Treasure Island, just because it's hilarious. But yeah, like it's hard to put, like I feel like as a someone who reads a lot of like classic literature, it kind of feels weird saying that I like this movie a lot more than I did the book, which is
no, I think that's absolutely fine. That's, you know,
well, I love that there was clearly like they were able to like shave down a lot of the excess that the book had to get to the core element that was supposed to, like, the emotional hook of the story, and they got it, and they did everything.
I mean,
right,
arguably I've read Christmas Carol a few times.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Muppets Christmas Carol is a really, really good adaptation that manages to like shave away the fat.
Mm-hmm.
And like the stuff that you don't need, and you know, and hang on to the heart of the story. So I think that's perfectly valid.
Yeah, because I mean, with different authors, it's always, you know, how much they choose to embellish in a particular story, and how much, you know, yeah, how much those elements, because it that can sometimes make or break a movie adaptation from a book adaptation, as I'm sure we've all experience in certain points when we've read a book and we've really enjoyed every aspect of it, and then we see it adapted into a movie and it can't quite hold a candle, because for whatever reason, however the movie was made, it's just like, okay, in cutting away aspects of the book that in order to make it fit with the runtime, like they somehow lost like the point of what made the story special. This was like the exact opposite. It took it took, like you said, it cut away the fat and basically enhanced like the core elements of the story that matter. But they were able to do it in a very unique flair that is going to, like, while it's still clearly an adaptation of Treasure Island, it's got its own identity thanks to its thanks to the unique setting that it's got and the unique look.
I think at the least, it's also just from an animation history standpoint, it's got some very fine animation in it.
Oh gosh, yeah, like Glenn Keane. Which I know is kind
of
like that.
Sometimes the equivalent of saying, "Oh, this movie's got great cinematography." In brackets, that's the only thing that's interesting about it. But I think animation's a bit, I don't know, different there, and there's a lot to get out of it. Like particularly, I think like was Long John Silver like the first hybrid animation character?
He
was like hybrid CG. His arm was CG, but like the rest of his body was 2D.
Well, there, I think that most of the mechanical aspects of his design were, yes, the arm in particular were computer generated models, where but on a 2D character, which was brilliantly done, and it still holds up.
Yeah,
like it's everything. Like, you'd think, considering how old the movie is, that the CG would feel out of place because due to, you know, how far that technology has come now. But I don't, like, the last couple times I've watched the movie, I've never gotten that feeling, which is impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes when you look at, like, old CG, like, you go back and you watch the original Jurassic Park, like, I guess in a little similar sense, like, you can still kind of see how the age in the animation when they animate the dinosaurs, but because the animation is done in such a way to not to more accent the film as opposed to be the only thing that's trying to hold it up, you're able to kind of suspend your disbelief a little bit in terms of the fact of noticing how old the animation is.
Yeah.
It's not Mummy Returns.
Oh, sorry, Chris.
If you want to see some animation that does not hold up, look at The Mummy Returns and Scorpion King. Rendered on PlayStation 1.
Oh no.
Rendered on the back of a napkin.
It didn't look good at the time. So,
Yeah.
Sorry, what was that, Evan?
Oh, no, it wasn't much. I was just saying that that kind of reminds me of a comment you made earlier when we were doing the Klaus podcast about how the 2D, like 2D and 3D animation can integrate to make something that's more aesthetically pleasing than like standalone 3D and maybe standalone 2D.
Yeah, that's something I remember when I was had my discussion with Glenn Keane and we were talking about Over the Moon. It was, I liked that at least in the work that he's doing, he's finding ways to kind of bring those two mediums together. And I'm continuously excited to see what those experiments will bring and will create. And it was cool to kind of go back and see where that they were starting to first mess around with that.
Yeah.
But okay. Unless we've got anything else, I think that might be just about, I know it's getting a little late for our folks in the UK, so I think it's probably a good time to sign off.
I did just one.
You say that like we're wearing our nightcaps and nodding off with a big cup of cocoa in our hands, which...
Well, you don't know. I haven't got my camera on. I could be.
You had something?
Just very quickly... funny that Dan mentioned about the Mickey Mouse cartoons. It reminded me to shout out something that someone who was a big part of the Mickey Mouse cartoons worked on. And it's something that we did a kickstart list about years ago.
Oh, right.
Like 5 years ago. Or no, you know, it's 4 years ago. It was 2016. So, yeah. Long Gone Gulch. Western animation, Western fantasy animation, created by Tara Billinger, who was a character designer or
storyboarder or something on...
She was character designer and now she's a storyboarder.
Yeah, oh, so she's done on Mickey Mouse shorts. And Zach Bellissimo, who has worked on... He does character design on Rick and Morty. Anyway, this is their like their self-created thing. And they did a pilot. It was a very popular Kickstarter. And they ended up changing it from an 8 to 11 minute short to a 21 minute thing. And it's now available on YouTube to watch. And hey! I recommend you do. It's a very cool piece of 2D animation, very stylistic. It's got cowboys in a very strange world populated by like monsters and Sasquatches. One of the characters is a random, one of the main characters is like a 50s greaser for some reason in the Old West. It's weird. It's just great. Watch it. It's on YouTube. And there is a watch this feature on it on animationparadox.com right now that you can check out if you want to read some more about it. So, yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for the recommendation. I forgot. I
shout that out quickly.
That does look interesting.
Okay. Well, again, guys, thank you for joining us for this bit more of casual conversation, but we'll see what the 2021 holds for this year in animation, and we'll celebrating films that we've been hoping to talk about for a little while, but also whatever's new coming down the line. And I guess, hold on, let me just make sure I've got my go through my mental checklist of all of all the promotional stuff. Go through every episode. Please, if you want to check out more of what we do on the website, especially like say the link that we'll have for the watch this that Chris just mentioned. Also feel free to check out the other watch this or recommended videos. I know that's a really that's a popular mini series of articles that we have, as well as play this and a recommended web animation watch is also a lot of fun. Chris and I, we go through a series of selected, varying different, websites, either YouTube, VMO of animation that just really, jumped out and caught our attention. And we want to make sure we share with as many people as possible. So
if my calculations are correct, we are approaching the 100th edition. Very soon.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, we'll have to do something special for that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, definitely check those out. And any of the other articles that catch your eye on the website. As always, please check out our social media accounts if you want to keep up to date with articles that come out, whether new releases for DVDs, streaming. Our different social media platforms are as follows. We are on Facebook at AFA Blog. We are on Twitter, also at AFA Blog. We are on Tumblr, Pinterest, Instagram, and I think that's everyone. I think.
Stitcher?
Are we on Stitcher?
We're on the podcast platforms as well, all the different ones, but we don't need to list them.
Oh.
But the big one, however, is I'm going to make sure that if you want to continue supporting the website and what we do or the podcast, please check out our Patreon page and look at our tier list for however much you want to submit Patreon little cup of coffee at Ko-fi is our other source of support. So I'll make sure to leave both of those links in the show notes if you want to check those out and support us. And as always, I want to make sure I give a shout out to Animation Nights New York and lovely Yvonne, who has supported us through, everything that this website's gone through, and we've tried to do as much as to support Animation Nights New York as well. And please check out their webpage, and or if you want to submit a film, they have a film submission list for their screenings, which I was hoping to maybe we can have a chat with Yvonne later on this year and see how that's going. But Chris, where can we find you on social media?
You can find me at Mr. Crystal on Twitter and Instagram.
And Dan?
You can find my bad tweets at Hamu on Twitter.
Very good. Good tweets. And yeah, both bad and good tweets. And Evan, how about yourself?
Just Facebook, Evan Vernon.
Very good. Everyone, stay healthy, stay safe, and we'll see you on the next episode of the AFA podcast. Take care.
Everybody needs just the right amount of fuel to get going in the morning. For some, a nice McDonald's egg and cheese bagel is just enough to do it. Others might prefer a McDonald's bacon egg and cheese bagel. Or perhaps a sausage egg and cheese bagel. And there are those where nothing will do but a hearty McDonald's steak egg and cheese bagel. Four different breakfast bagels to get you going. Tomorrow morning, give your engine a head start at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At Busch Gardens Christmas Town, rekindle the spirit of holiday traditions for you and your family. Delight in the wonder of over 10 million twinkling lights. Cherish the moments as you enjoy new holiday shows and visit Santa and Rudolph. And immerse yourself in a world transformed by the season at the world's most beautiful theme park. The holidays shine brightest at Busch Gardens Christmas Town. Select dates through January 2nd. Right now, it's the best deal of the season. Save over 50% with tickets as low as $24.99. Restrictions apply.